ever beyond. On Wolf Spirit Radio, everbeyondradio.com, Tiernasau from Ireland, ScottishSovereignsOnTheLand.ning.com. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning. Welcome to Ever Beyond on Ever Beyond Radio and Wolf Spirit Radio, as you heard. And indeed, let me just plug in Scottish Sovereigns and Tiernasau, and I hope my bandwidth will hold up. So welcome Tiernasau, welcome Scottish Sovereigns on the Land, people for people. Tonight, I'm so pleased. Many of the regular listeners to Wolf Spirit Radio will have an idea that I've been following a thread of information which wasn't really talked about very much in the last 70 years, but has affected us on a subtle and profound level, I believe. And to that end, tonight I've invited on a person who I believe is going to give us more pieces of our puzzle. His name is Jim Nichols. Many of you will have heard of him. His most famous piece of work, well, I think his most famous piece of work at the moment, is known as the Aldebaran Mystery, or Aldebaran Mystery. Now, I pronounce it Aldebaran in order to emphasize the Ra of it. But everybody's got their own different pronunciations, and probably they call it something else themselves. So we'll talk about that too. Without going too deeply into the subject, we know that there was time travel, dimensional travel experiments done by both the Nazi Germans and the American group and the Project Rainbow, which is known as the Philadelphia Experiment. There was a concurrently at the same time in Germany was an experiment called Die Glocke, or the bell, and this was a device. We will talk about it later. It was a super secret operation. Nobody knew about it. There were hundreds of thousands of people involved. Most of them were killed at the end of what they did. So very few whistleblowers. Very few people survived the end of the Glock project. And it's not known where a lot of them went. Now, I've been doing some digging. Jim has been doing a vast amount of digging. He's probably done a lot more digging than me, because I've been doing it a couple of years. But without further ado, good afternoon, Jim. How are you? How's things?
Very good, thank you.
Tucson, Arizona.
Delightful to chat with you all the way up in Scotland. And what time and what day is it there?
it's still Sunday. It's 11 p.m. here in Scotland. So okay. I'm a late bird. Don't worry about me. I'm up all night anyway. So because I've been running this Pacific based internet radio station for 3-4 years now. So I'm used to Pacific time. So, well, Jim, fantastic to have you on. Thank you for coming. I'm really pleased. Let's stop talking about how pleased I am. Let's get to the meat and potatoes. What happened? When did you start? What brought this onto your radar? What brought the bell and all these time travel, dimensional travel projects into your radar?
Well, we have to go back to just the very idea that the Germans were building flying saucers, which I got involved in doing UFO art back in 1980, and I was pretty much a novice at the time, and I thought, you know, all flying saucers come from outer space, end of story, right? But about that same time, in about 1980, 82, I came across a novel by a gentleman named W.A. Harbinson, and I don't know if you're familiar with that name, but it's a novel called Genesis. And it was a fictional story about a kind of a mad scientist kind of guy, some like a James Bond villain kind of guy, who was actually developing flying discs for the Nazis during World War II. And I thought, well, that's an interesting concept. But at the very end of his book, W.A. Harbinson had an appendix of actual research that he had done that verified that, yes, indeed, the Nazis were building circular flying machines during the Second World War, which was just completely blew me out of the water. It was such a shocking revelation that I just never could shake free of it. And over the next few years, I came across more information about it, and you know, it's fragmented. You find it in little snippets in books here and books there, and there's no, at the time, there was no clear cut. Yes, this is the story of the German saucer programs. There was nothing like that in those days. And so I kept, you know, but I had my good friend was Colonel Wendell Stevens, who was retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel and pilot in World War II. And at that point, he was a 20-year veteran researcher in flying saucers. Well, he published a book about that same time called Crash at Aztec, which is, you know, an account of the alleged UFO crash at Aztec, New Mexico. Well, in that book, there was an appendix also about flying saucers built by the Germans. And there were schematics, actually, schematic drawings of some of the, you know, preliminary designs for Nazi saucers. And I thought, you know, just for fun, just for my own entertainment, since I was already doing UFO and flying saucer illustrations, I wonder what it would look like if I was to paint a scene that took one of these saucer designs and made it look like it was really happening. It was like a test flight of an experimental flying disc craft that was, you know, based on what the designs out of Wendell's research and Wendell's books. Well, lo and behold, that has become one of the most internationally popular UFO paintings on the planet. And I never dreamed, at that time, when I did that painting, how profoundly enticing that would be to the whole world. And so it's like, well, one thing leads to another, and I said, so after that, I sat down with Wendell, and I really went over a lot of the research, the serious research that he had been doing, and to try to fill in the background story of all this. And so what you see in my YouTube video, The Aldebaran Mystery, or you can read it on my website, my blog, is the culmination of all that research.
It's a wonderful, I have to say. I watched it, because Tolek said, oh, and by the way, hi Tolek, hi Adonna, they're all listening. Hi Debriel, hello Agatha, old ones, yes, it's great. We got a really, really enormous chat room. Loads of people checking out here, it's been really good. Tracy, Nancy, hi everybody. So, yes, and Richard, hi Richard. So, here's the thing. Right, now I don't understand what... there's questions starting to come in, and that one didn't actually make sense. Jim, didn't three men get one work?
Oh, excuse me?
There's a question. It was a question that says, didn't three men get one work? I don't think there's... I think there's some words missing there. So,
yeah.
But anyway... let's go back to, there was Wendell Stevens. Now, Wendell Stevens has got some very interesting information about what happened after the war, but we'll cover that later. Mm-hmm. Let's keep going back. So you discovered that the Nazis were actually responsible for making UFO craft. And they seem to be very similar designs to those ones that people were drawing in you know, in sightings. They were seeing these kind of tin can things going around. And so when did you first see, oh, wow, look, there's a bloody flying saucer with swastikas on it. When did you see that one?
I mean, what? Let's move ahead a little bit. In 1991, I met a young Bulgarian researcher at a UFO conference. That was in, here in Tucson, 1991. Wendell Stevens had the first World UFO Congress here. And we had Marina Popovich. We had a Russian cosmonaut here. I don't know if you know Tony Dodd from Yorkshire. He was a UFO researcher that was here at that time. And I get to meet a young researcher from Bulgaria by the name of Vladimir Terzisky. And Vladimir, you know, Wendell always said he was a KGB. But even if he was, it's like he had access to an incredible wealth of information about the German saucers. And in fact, I did. He used my Nazi saucer painting on the cover of one of his books. So that just fleshed it out even more. And it's like, you know, this is when Vladimir had what claimed to be actual photographs from the war of the real deal Nazi flying saucers. And apparently this was, the way I understand it, this was film footage that had worked its way into the Soviet Union at the time, and then it worked its way down into Australia, and it appeared in an Australian production about the saucers of the Third Reich, and then later on there was UFO Secrets of the Third Reich, another video documentary that surfaced about this subject, and that fleshed it out once again. That just added more detail to the story. And so
that's interesting because that's part of I believe that the information that he got there was from the interrogation of General Sporenberg, who was captured at Castle Kziatz. Still can't pronounce it properly. Which is one where they did the deep bell research and the red mercury thing.
Okay.
So, and then I think Nick Pope might have gotten hold of some of the... I think maybe one or two pages of the transcripts have been kind of sent out and from the KGB after it was dispersed.
Well, you know, what was interesting, I grew up as a kid back in the 50s, and I can remember prior to 1960, there was all kind of talk that you know, our government was developing anti-gravity flying machines. It was talked about very generally. And if you go back and look at the classic movie Forbidden Planet, you see this magnificent flying saucer that is being flown by military people from planet Earth, by, you know, like they're like Americans. It's like this isn't being flown by extraterrestrials or little gray men. This beautiful flying saucer is built by humans from planet Earth and proudly flying its way around the universe. And in one sequence, they actually pull out the magnetic drive of the anti-gravity magnetic drive of this flying saucer to work on it. And it's like, this movie was like a commercial, an infomercial for anti-gravity flying machines. And this is 1956, but then 4 years later, they rolled out the Avro disc, and they proved to the public that flying saucer technology is bogus, that you can't make flying saucers fly, and the whole thing is a lot of nonsense, and everything we saw from there was, you know, Wernher von Braun's rockets.
That's very interesting.
It's like, wait a minute. The whole anti-gravity thing just went black. It went deep black. And if you've read Nick Cook's book, Hunt for Zero Point, He stumbled onto this fact and started to do some research on his own. And this is a guy who had carte blanche. He could walk into any aerospace industry, you know, headquarters, his background was writing, about aerospace technology and so forth. Well, he discovered that if he went back to those same aerospace industries like McDonnell Douglas or whatever, and happened to breathe the word anti-gravity, he was like suddenly persona non grata. It's like you have stepped across a line here. You do not dare speak of this. And so he became so fascinated. Well, why is this a taboo topic? I mean, so then he did his research into anti-gravity and so forth. And, the long and the short of it is like, okay, there's a very serious, very profound technology that was being worked on, I would say, during the course of World War II that's absolutely revolutionary and to this day is deep, dark, black secret.
Absolutely. Now, from what I understand, in the mid-50s, there were patents that were, or patents, as you call it, mm-hmm. there were patents that were submitted, and this is I got this from Cliff High, that in the early half of that decade, they said that the there were patents in the early 50s that were saying we are looking to research and investigate gravity control, and mm-hmm. in 1956 they say we are going to exploit gravity control systems. So it was a sea change of we're looking for the things, now we've found it, we're going to use it. And that's, as you say, that's when things start to go deep black. So obviously the corporations, they formed shell corporations around these ideas and then compartmentalized everything and brought it into how we see it today. Is like every company produces a component and then somebody brings them all together to create all these things. So I'm fully in agreement with you. Anti-grav, well, and here's another thing. I've had William Stillings. I don't know if you've heard of William Stillings. He was part of Project Pegasus in the 1960s. He was one of those kids that were sent through wormholes through time. One of them was Andrew Basago, and another one was Barack Obama, or Barry Satoru at the time, apparently. Also Regina Dugan. And they were all part of this time travel project, and because they were little, they could go through the wormholes, and they couldn't get big wormholes at the time. Anyway, long story. But essentially, that in the 1950s, that they did have a gravity technology. Now, what Stirling says to me is that there's no such thing as anti-gravity. He's very stern about it. He says, gravity is a wave. And when you understand that, you understand that we have been told false science. Do you want to talk a little about how you've discovered that false science for yourself?
False science.
Well, the idea that gravity sucks, you know, and doesn't push.
I think it was just... Well, it actually was later on. My original in W.A. Harbinson's book, the flying saucer technology he was talking about was actually conventionally powered, turbojet powered, and Vladimir talks about this, that there were two distinct units within the Third Reich that were working on circular flying machines. One was Luftwaffe, and they were using regular turbojet engines to try to develop some, you know, precursors of what today we have are helicopters. But they were using conventional turbojet engines for that and kerosene rocket or kerosene aviation fuel. Very conventional stuff. But if you dig a little bit deeper, and one of the things you have to throw into the mix here is secret societies. And I'm sure we'll come to that. But the Nazi SS, and a lot of people simply don't understand it, that the SS was formed as a secret society. It was like a Reich within the Reich. And you can't just, it's not just, well, the Third Reich is one big enchilada and it's all one thing. It's not. It's, and you mentioned compartmentalization, and this was the third, or the Nazi SS were absolute masters of compartmentalization. And we have seen the adaptation of that same compartmentalization within our own intelligence and top secret corporate and black project operations. Compartmentalization is absolutely essential. You can't ever let the left hand know what the right hand is doing. So within the SS, this is where the flying, the anti-gravity flying technology, I suspect, was actually a top priority. And it was completely separate from, and you must understand, completely separate from what the Luftwaffe was doing. Yeah, there was two agencies within the Third Reich working on flying disc projects that were totally separate from each other. And then you have the Nazi Bell, you know, the Die Glocke operation, which was totally separate from those, from the flying disc projects. So once again, it's like you can't put it all in the same basket. They're working with similar complementary technologies, but each project is completely compartmentalized, so it's completely separate. So it took me a long time to get a handle on that, and then I could start to understand, okay, well, now I can start to see the picture that, yeah, there's where even the Third Reich itself was keeping the anti-gravity torsion technology propulsion systems really deep secret as well.
And the way that the Nazis keep their secrets is not by people making promises. They mostly stick them in a hole, get them to do the research, and when they've finished the research, boom. The person is never heard of once again. And that's the way the Nazis keep secrets. So watch out when you're working with Nazis. If you're giving them information, it won't last long for you. So,
well, let me go on with this. Also, and this is what Wendell Stevens became aware of. He says what the Germans would, it's like within the SS there was a core within the Reich that understood, I mean, early on, that they were not really fighting to win the European war. That it's almost like they had a goal way beyond the Second World War that they were shooting towards. And Wendell would say, he says, what they would do is they would design a prototype flying disc, they would go out and take it out and test it, and if it worked, they would dismantle it, pack it up, and ship it out of Germany, get it out of there as fast as they could. And they would load it on U-boats, and they would send it either to Argentina or South America or the Antarctica, wherever. But there seemed to be a concerted effort to develop the technologies as quickly as possible, see if they worked, and then get them out of Germany. And it's like, that makes no sense, because, why didn't you use these technologies to win the war, for crying out loud? Well, it's like, you know, the European war is not our main concern here. There's something beyond the European war that we seem to be developing this technology for, and it's like, you can leave it to your imagination what on earth that would be. But, it's like, so much of it's incredible technology that they're working on, but then they never turn around and capitalize on using this this technology, you know, in a tactical sense to win the war. It's except that that's one of the reasons why everybody scoffs at the whole idea of Nazi saucers. Well, if they had flying saucers, they would have won the war. Ha ha ha. Well, it's apparently they weren't particularly interested in winning that war. Maybe there's another war out there in the future that they were more concerned about winning. And that's high-octane speculation on my part, but that's one of the strange aspects of this whole mystery.
Wow. So somebody was saying, talking about the president, I just said, I just put in the chat room, Mr. President, I'm afraid you don't have the security clearance.
Right.
The famous quote from George H.W. Bush, is that correct?
Something like that, or from Independence Day. It's like, well, if they were flying saucers at Area 51, I'd know about it. That's what the president says, ha ha ha, and then his Secretary of Defense says, well, excuse me, Mr. President, that's not exactly correct.
Let's just take you around there. And this was about the time that Bill Clinton was saying, I'm going to go down to Area 51, find out what's in there. And they took him to a room and they said, Mr. President, if we show you, we'll have to kill you.
Basically, I'm sorry, Mr. President, you don't have high enough security clearance for that.
Exactly.
All right.
There's a lovely thing that Jimmy Kimmel, as you can get on YouTube, is talking to Obama, and Obama is kind of speaking in a joking sense, and he's saying, "Ah, well, the aliens that control us don't let us do very much, and you know they wouldn't let me say that," and stuff like that. I'm saying it in a joking way, but actually, from our point of view, he's actually telling the truth, hidden in plain sight.
Exactly.
So. Let's span out a little bit and go back to the idea that the information, right? Because what we find is that the Germans, there was the Red Baron here, he's in his little Sopwith camel held together by sellotape string and canvas, and it turns out that, you know, in 15 years they managed to go from that to flying machines, flying saucers, flying, you know, anti-gravity craft. There was intervention, or there was another influence, and this is where our conversation really starts to literally lift off the ground. Do you want to talk about what you know about the Vril, Darman? And then I'm gonna put forward a little nugget for you. Go on.
Okay. The Vril Society, the good old Vril Society. Let's go back even further. Where did the word Vril come from, and who was it that first coined that word? And I'm having a brain freeze here.
I can't remember his name either.
The author's name escapes me, but I will find it here.
It was called The Coming Race, wasn't it?
Yes, Edward Bulwer Lytton.
There we go.
In the late 1800s, wrote about this hidden society that lives, you know, in the inner earth, and very sophisticated technologically, and they used some kind of advanced technology that they referred to as Vril, and the way he describes Vril sounds very much like free energy or some kind of torsion physics energy. And so it's like, well, that was in the span of time between World War I and World War II, this kind of research was very interesting to German occult groups and New Age group. There was a profound New Age movement in Germany between the wars, and one of the things they wanted to find was a new technology, new free energy technology that would liberate Germany from the codependence on British and American petroleum companies. And so this search for this kind of energy got top priority within the Third Reich. And I don't know if you're aware of the they set up a special research group within the Third Reich, and like you see in Indiana Jones, it's like, well, these crazy Nazis are going all over the country, all over the planet, looking for, you know, exotic technologies. That's exactly what they were doing, because they realized that in ancient times, back before the Egyptians and the Babylonians even, that there was an technologically advanced civilization on this planet that had the kind of technology that the Nazis were looking for. And they knew it was real, and they were looking for evidence of it all over the world. They were in Tibet, they were in Iraq, they were in Egypt, they were everywhere. And the question is, did they find it? And I rather suspect they did. And that the Vril Society was keenly, was directly involved in this, very highly involved in this. And you can, you know, so many people scoff at, you know, the absurdity of Nazi saucers. But if you go back and read the ancient Sanskrit texts that talk about the Vimana, the flying machines of ancient times, and there's this epic poem called the Samarangana Sutradhara, which makes the very blunt statement that strong and durable must the body of the Vimana be made, like a great flying bird of light material. Inside, one must put the mercury engine with its iron heating apparatus underneath. By means of power latent in the mercury, which sets the driving whirlwind in motion, a man sitting inside may travel a great distance in the sky. The movements of the Vimana are such that it can vertically ascend, vertically descend, or move slanting forwards and backwards. With the help of machines, human beings can fly through the air, and heavenly beings can come down to earth. Now pay very close attention, because he mentions the driving whirlwind, the mercury engine which creates the driving whirlwind. Well, what's a whirlwind? That's torsion physics. They are describing, these ancient texts are describing very simply torsion physics.
Absolutely.
That is the key to anti-gravity. That is the key to free energy technology right there.
Excellent. So we're very, very learned in the chat room. Here we go. And Sister Tracy is here saying Vril is a Sanskrit word meaning vital magnetism. So that's a good.
Right.
So it was.
Well, I always thought of as life force energy.
Yeah. So the Edward Litton wrote the book. And he was talking about a whole race of people who used Vril as their kind of regular energy form. You know, it's like batteries. So essentially what they're talking about is we have our mobile phone batteries and we have to plug them in every day because they run out. Or me, I seem to crash batteries. You know, they last about half the time with me. They're not a very good technology, but they're... If one had one kind of microgram of red mercury inside a battery, you could probably have a thing that would run forever, and it would power your mobile phone forever. That sort of thing are we talking about?
Yeah, but that doesn't make any money for the petroleum industry.
Exactly. Well, we were talking about that earlier.
We're still stuck in capitalism here, where we have to keep, keep putting petrol in your automobile, and that's what keeps the whole thing going. And this is a multi-billion-dollar international economic structure that wants to maintain itself. So consequently, things like free energy and torsion physics and things like this tend to get brushed off off a mainstream radar.
Yeah,
I was trying to, the word I was trying to think of was Ananurba. The Ananurba Society was a specific society within the Third Reich that was specifically created to research these ancient technologies, and apparently they were very successful at it.
Well, this is also connected with a film that was with Brad Pitt. He was, do you remember, it's called 7 Years in Tibet.
In Tibet, yes.
And Brad Pitt played a German scientist who went to, and they went all over the world to as ancient as places they could, places where they heard that you could get through to Agartha, the inner earth, places that had contact with them, to find out about who these people were. From what I can understand... Well, let's just keep going. I want you to keep going. So you have your one of your societies. Now that's what was their name? Hanibu? No, not Hanibu. What was the name of this society you were just talking about? The investigation.
The Annenerbe.
Annenerbe. I've not heard
Annenerbe Society.
All right, I've not heard of that.
Very, very important society in Germany.
Okay, so there's Annenerbe, and then there's Ultima Thule, and the Vril people, Vril Gesellschaft. I'm learning German. I'm learning my pronunciation ever since I started investigating this. Because apparently there are 750,000 new scientific terms that were discovered by the Nazis.
But you have to understand that the Annenerbe was not a secret society. The Annenerbe was a state-funded metaphysical research group that was commissioned to go all over the world to find these alternative energy sources. And even the occult, and this is a very key component here, to not just look for prosaic fundamental energy sources, like petroleum, like alternatives to petroleum and so forth. This was also to engage the occult, and this is a key component to the Third Reich flying disc story that has to really be understood clearly.
So, yes. Now, we're again looking at what the Nazis... So they were investigating all over the planet. They were looking for the ancient technologies. They were also looking for what they called the master race. Right. And I think this now starts to connect in with the channelings by Maria Orsic and Segrin of the Vril Society.
Well, let's back up.
Are we there yet, or have we got still got a bit more to go?
Let's back up just a little bit.
Okay.
You mentioned 7 years in Tibet. Well, that flows with Helena Blavatsky's claim to be connected to the ascended masters from Tibet, and it was her channeling and so forth, and her occult research that led to the concept of the Aryan race, and the Aryan race were connected to ancient Atlantis, and the Aryans were the super race that possessed these incredible technologies, these incredible free energy technologies. And so it was through Blavatsky's bringing forth this idea of the super Aryan race, the blue-eyed blonde race, that the Nazis and the Third Reich and the Vril Society all latched onto, and that became a very core idea within the rise of the Third Reich.
So then we then start to search for the ancients. They found some technologies, but presumably they didn't find a full working Vimana. They may have found pieces of one or rotted bits of one. What did they discover, do you know?
I'm not sure. I think it would probably be a deep, dark secret even today. But this is where the Vril Society and Maria Orsic and that group kind of steps up on center stage here. And because one of the things they discovered is that there was a group of Teutonic Templar knights during the 13th century, I believe it was, who claimed to have contact with extraterrestrials from the Aldebaran star system in the constellation of Taurus. And it was in 1919 that the ladies of the Vril Society, led by Maria Orsic, also claimed to have made telepathic contact with the same society, the same extraterrestrial group from Aldebaran. So this is where we start to get into the Aldebaran part of the mystery here.
The Aldebaran mystery. Oh, didn't work. Oh, well. I got these sound effects, but I don't always have the right... The Aldebaran mystery! Yes,
good.
There we go. So, let's now talk a little about the Vril Society itself. Do you know very much about them?
I followed mostly just the story of Maria Orsic and her involvement with W.O. Schumann and the channelings of the alleged channelings that she and her ladies. There was a group of ladies within the Vril Society who wore their hair, down to their ankles, and claimed that their hair was like acted as psychic antennas that made their transmissions clearer or whatever. But there's kind of a gray area where the Vril Society and the Thule Society. It seems like the Vril to me seemed to be more esoteric, and where the Thule Society seemed to be more political. And the Thule Society was taking the concepts and a lot of the information that was being channeled to the Vril Society, and they were reworking it into what would later become the National Socialist philosophy. So I see the Thule Society as really engineering the Third Reich, or the rise of Hitler itself, because they had, and I could be wrong on this, but they seemed to have more political ambitions, where the Vril Society had more esoteric ambitions. Like they believed that a utopia could be created here that would benefit everybody, not just Germany. And where the Thule Society, I think, saw it more from a very limited nationalistic point of view, and something that would liberate Germany once and for all from, codependence on Germany's conquerors, the United States and Britain. So I think there was this political divergence between the Vril and the Thule Society, and but then that's just kind of speculative on my part. But that seems to, I don't see where I have not come across much information that showed that Maria Orsic and her ladies were really hardcore Nazis. I think they were much more esoteric than that. And I think that had they done that, I think it would have been detrimental to the psychic work they were actually doing. But anyway, the ladies did channel, writings and so forth that were later seemed to display technical designs for building a flying disc or a time machine. Actually, they originally called it a time machine, but it could accomplish either goals. Once you access this torsion field distortion, you're not just distorting gravity, but you're making distortions in time and space also.
Exactly. Now, I too have been doing some research, and I'd like to share these bit. I've got some insights and nuggets. Number one, in the film and the book series Dune, by Frank Herbert, there was a female secret society called the Bene Gesserit.
Yes.
And in the book, they're portrayed, or in the film, they're portrayed as having bald heads.
Hmm.
I think that he is actually talking about the Vrildamen, and that the bald head is a signal that it's not bald, it's the opposite of bald, the very, very long hair, to be as psychic as they are. The Bene Gesserit are very psychic. They do all their psychic stuff. So that's one little nugget. Now, as I said, as promised, I'm going to give you I'm going to give everybody a little nugget. If everybody goes, I put the show notes of the this particular show on Ever Beyond Radio. Let me just grab the link again, so everybody can go onto that page. And if you go to Ever Beyond Radio, you're just listening, you can click on the top link. Says Jim Nichols, Algebra and Mystery. I'm just going to paste it in the chat room here so that people can follow this. Now, what I've done, and I'll just pop it here for you, Jim, so that you can see where I'm going with this. So if you open that page, and you will see that there's your biography and various other links, and then at the bottom there is a series of photographs, series of pictures, and what I'd like you to look at is, first of all, you see the top there, and there's two women that appear to have their ponytails kind of hooked together. And what you're actually looking at is a sort of gondola, like a Venetian gondola. Can you see that? And then,
yes.
If you look below that, you'll see the Vril blue and black and white logo. Now, you might think, oh, well, that sort of, that looks a bit like space travel-y or something like that. But if you then scroll down a little bit further, you will see another very sexy picture of a black leather-clad Vril Daman. But below that, there's a picture of an ancient Egypt papyrus. And on that papyrus is Ra. Remember, we were talking about Aldebaran. Ra standing on the boat, what's known as the boat of Ra. Okay, now this is all going to come together very, very quickly. If you look at the boat of Ra, you'll see that it's got these kind of strange ends, and the first end comes down and sweeps over to the right, and you carry on and you go along to the length of the boat, and then it suddenly changes direction and it sweeps back up to the same direction. So you see the beginning and the end come in at the same angle, and this is what I want you to look at. Can you see the unique shape of the boat? It's not normal. It doesn't kind of go up at both ends. It kind of hooks back at the on the right. You see that?
Exactly. Right.
Okay. Now, if you then scroll back up to the Vril Daman logo, and then drop it down, make it fall down to the left, and you will see that you're looking at the same figure. You're looking at two paths that are following the same direction that come out, and basically what the logo is a depiction of the boat of Ra, which is, and then we scroll down further, we see what we're talking about. It's a wormhole. So the logo is the actual shape of the wormhole, in my particular humble opinion. What do you think of that?
Well, I think you're onto something. I think the Egyptians were onto something.
That's right.
Right.
One more little thing is, I don't know if you ever watched shows like Stargate or Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you see, whenever they go through the vortex, it's not like a... It's like it goes... It changes direction, mm-hmm, as they go through the wormhole. And there does seem to become some kind of point where it stops and reverses direction. And I think that is that little hook, that little elbow that we're looking at on the boat of Ra, on the Vril diagram. We're talking about an Einstein-Rosen bridge or a wormhole.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, below your Einstein-Rosen bridge image there, you have the boat. Now, is that the boat of Ra?
That's right. And there's Ra right at the front. He's the guy with the big circle on his head, and he's got an eagle face, face, yes.
Taurus, yes, okay. So were the Egyptians talking in metaphor here?
Well,
revealing their keen understanding, which is, essentially came from, if you read Manly Hall, what the Egyptians knew actually came from the great Atlantean society that predated Egypt. And this is what we are looking at, is just a metaphor for the hyperdimensional, travel that the Egyptians fully understood.
Okay, so now we know that the Egyptians knew it. We know possibly that before Egypt there were civilizations. Or maybe something started there. But from what I understand, that this is to do with the people that became the Sumerians.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't seem, from what I understand, we're not talking about an invasion, because it's already happened. It happened thousands and thousands of years ago.
Not an invasion, is a colonization.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that's what the real society understood. That's the information that they had gained, and that the planet that orbits the Aldebaran star, the civilization there is, or the planet is called Sumi Air. It's Sumi Dash Air. And, according to the research that Wendell Stevens did, that the Sumerians, or the beings from Aldebaran, spoke in a language that was phonetically similar or virtually identical to spoken German.
And not only that, but Orsich was channeling these characters, and she didn't realize it, what she was reading. What did you hear about that?
Well, the channel writing was virtually identical to ancient Sumerian Sanskrit or ancient Sumerian text, and Maria and the ladies of the Vril would channel this writing, and they had no clue what they were writing, but they were Oriental scholars within the Vril society who recognized the writing as ancient Sumerian.
So now let's did you once so have you heard of any of the actual how can I put this? The writings, or did the Vril Society actually ever publish anything publicly, as opposed to anything that they told to the Nazis, or was it all behind closed doors, and then eventually the Nazis shot them all, or they tried to escape, or something?
I would say that there's probably a wealth of material that's been very carefully secreted away. Because even at the end of the war, Winston Churchill, when they had the Nuremberg trials, they tried very, very hard to suppress any and all references to the occult interest of the Third Reich. So we have we're only now just rediscovering the profoundly occult, the depth of the occult influence within the Third Reich. So, and that's the kind of information that they would have wanted absolutely secret.
And indeed, this is the kind of information that if it were to come out now, before they were coming out, before they rose from their underground bases and everything, might steal their thunder. It wouldn't be so much of a surprise if we actually knew that there were Nazis underground all over the world, wouldn't it?
It would be. It would be very disconcerting, because we have... since World War II, there's been such a profoundly concerted effort to completely re-engineer the whole public perception of World War II. And it's like, I think we're seeing snippets of, this whole epic, or this whole historical episode, is not quite what we've been told that it was.
It's not, has it? Let's go through some of the myths. Bust the myths with the truth. How about that?
Well, now let's keep going with your images here. Now, tell me about the image here on the Spear von Sargon II.
Oh, yes, Sargon.
Yeah, please tell me about that.
Now, this, I believe, is the Spear of Destiny. Now, one of our co-hosts on this very station had a very strong connection as an incarnation, apparently, of General Patton.
Yes.
Who knew of the occult significance of the spear.
Mm-hmm.
And so what apparently happened was that the spear... So, I'll put that in the spear, because it's connected with the spear of... The Spear of Sargon has this scratched... The Vril Society logo is scratched onto the surface of this this thing, which...
Is that
symbol originally on this before the Vril Society, or did somebody from the Vril Society scratch this onto the spear?
That's a good question. I wonder if anybody knows about this. Let's see if anybody in the chat room or anybody's listening, because people will listen to this show months in ahead, many months' time, And just send us an email if you get any more nuggets, because we're all trying to put this picture together before the picture gets completed. That's what I get the idea.
Since you brought this up about the Spear of Destiny, that the Nazis were also desperate to find the cup, the Holy Grail, the actual cup, because they believe that that possession of the Spear of Destiny and the cup, one representing the male energy and one representing the female energy, that once they had those two items together, that that would give them incredible, incredible power. So it wasn't just the desperation to find the spear. They had to find the cup, the Holy Grail cup, as well.
Oh, wow. So, did that happen?
I don't know.
Right.
But I know that's what they were looking for, desperate to look for.
So that's that. Yes, yeah. So what they and then the story is that as the Allies were invading Berlin and everywhere, that they actually discovered that there was a little tunnel, and then the guys went down the tunnel, and there at the end was the box with the spear in it, and they brought it to Patton. I hope I'm getting this story right, Nancy. That they brought it to Patton, and as Patton held the spear in his hand, the Vril energy leapt from the spear into Patton. So it's energetic, its soul, if you like, actually moved into a person rather than being a thing. So that was an interesting sort of corollary to this story. So whatever is the Spear of Destiny these days doesn't actually, it's dead. It's like a relic. It's not, it doesn't have the same energy in it because the energy has left the thing.
So what happened to this energy when they murdered Patton?
Well, I believe it's gone into the earth, which is where it's supposed to, where it's supposed to go. So it's kind of grounded the energy.
So that
it can't be misused anymore. It can't be just one person wielding the thing. It's like everybody has to be on board this time, rather than just.
Well, I hope that's true.
Me too. So, but it fits in with the way things are working. So yeah. So there was a little excursion through some of the symbolism that I've been looking through in the last few months, last year, since I've been investigating this. One thing that I came across about last November time, I started reading books out. And on the air, so like a book at bedtime, a book that came across my field of vision. I was searching for it, and I was looking for. I can't remember. I did a Google search for Red Mercury or something like that, because I knew that's something that. And came across a book which was called Die Glocke by Kelsey Bowman. Mm-hmm. I read it out. I didn't read it just for myself, I read it for everybody at the same time, and it's available from my website. You can download it for free, and you can listen to this amazing book. What this book is, Jim, and we're going to take a break in a second, but what this book is the only surviving member, because the Nazis thought, Sporenberg was convinced that that he'd killed everybody. But through the book, and you will understand how in the book it works, he was able to hide in the castle's old secret tunnel system. And so while all the hit squads were going around killing people, this guy was hiding, and he eventually got arrested by the Allies and taken over in Project Paperclip, and became a Nazi. Nazis are still active. NASA. Scientist.
Yes.
People say never a straight answer. I say Nazis are still active.
Nazis are still active, right. Okay.
So, it's a fascinating book. I'll just give you a little brief during the break. I've got some nuggets for you, if I may, share some with
delightful.
You in the second hour. And maybe we'll take some more questions. But we've got a lovely song for you. It's by Enya, because we played some Enya earlier, and this one's called Aldebaran. How amazing.
Okay.
And welcome back to Ever Beyond. Tonight, Nazis with flying saucers. Oh yes, Nazis with time machines. What could be the worst thing you could imagine? Nazis with time machines. Don't you think? Yeah, like Daleks. Essentially Daleks. Anyway, so I'm speaking with Jim Nichols, my new best buddy in Nazi technology research. And and in fact, you know, you are a fantastic graphic artist. Do you want to talk a little bit about, like, how did art meet UFOs for you?
Well, I've never seen a UFO. I was a good artist, and I've never seen a UFO. I says, well, the hell with it. If the UFOs won't appear for me, I'll just paint my own. And so that's it's a way for me to explore, you know, this whole mystery very vicariously. It's like, well, I don't get to see a flying saucer, but I've sure seen a lot of them in the movies. And so, and that's, you know, I'm very visually oriented, and so I'm thinking, well, you know, if what would it be like if I was out in the desert and a flying disc came down and hovered right over me? So I paint that, and I do that painting. Or what would it be like if I was standing out on the tarmac at a secret facility in, you know, in Austria or in Poland, where they're test flying a flying saucer? The Nazis are test flying a flying saucer during World War II. He's like, I can put myself, or I can create that experience visually and make it a visceral experience.
Wow. So, yeah, I'm sitting here thinking, I wonder if Jim has actually seen these things. He's been flashed, like was even the MIB film, you know. You don't remember it. Yet, in your subconscious, you thought, I wonder what a UFO looks like. And then somebody comes along to one of your exhibitions and says, I saw that once. How many people have done that, Jim?
Well, or let's take it another step and say, well, maybe I was there. Maybe, you know, maybe I was one of the people working on this. Maybe this is a past life experience. And that, and I really look at the synchronicity of my own life. It's like, and how I, you know, I didn't set out, Jay, I did not set out to go looking for this stuff. It's just kind of fallen into my lap over the course of my life. And I thought, well, you know, why would this kind of stuff come my way? And why would I find it so fascinating? And why, you know, it's like, so, you know.
I know exactly how you feel. I know exactly how you feel. That is exactly my feeling, too. Why do I know this? Why am I interested? What's this got to do with me? Yes. And then we start talking about past lives and weird stuff like that.
And then you show me a picture of Maria Orsic, and I think she's just a drop-dead gorgeous, you know, woman. And it's like, wow. It's like, even after all these years, the images of this woman are still seductive. So, well, what's that all about?
Haunting. Haunting.
It is haunting. And then, okay. And then in 1980, what really got me into the whole UFO thing was Wendell Stevens' investigation of the Billy Meyer contact in Switzerland. And who is Billy Meyer's primary contactee or primary extraterrestrial contact in that story? And it's, once again, this beautiful, long-haired, blonde woman from the Pleiades called Semyasi. And I thought, well, if you look at the picture, you know, depictions of some, if you look at my illustrations of Semyasi and you compare them to the photographs of Maria Orsic, it gets even spookier.
And
because I did the illustration of Semyasi years before I ever heard of who Maria Orsic was. And you know, here's this beautiful woman from the Pleiades who Billy Meyer has, you know, conversations with, and she's given him explicit details of the German flying saucer programs from World War II. So I said, what is going on here? you, if you have an answer, let me know.
Okay. I might have some. By the end of this show, you may know. We're gonna you know, this is very unusual that I'm kind of independent. You know, I got an independent. I've done my own research. You see, and I just love adding research to people's research, because it's like we all have a piece of the puzzle, and everybody's got a piece of each other's puzzle. So whenever I have a conversation or a show with people, like, I go away with more, and they go away with more. I hope. Anyway, so now Maria and all of these things, they were all featured. As I said, about just before the end of the first hour, that sometime at the end of last year, I was doing some search and I found this book. This book was called Die Glocke, and those of you who have been listening to Wolfsberry Radio are probably bored to tears about Die Glocke, because I read it out. I read the whole book, chapter by chapter. In, you know, easy bite sound files, you can, you know, listen to an hour at a time or something. And it has the story of one of the scientists who was the was on the original team that researched the bell. The book is, as I said, called Die Glocke, and it's written as a dramatization of journals that were passed from one guy to another to another, sort of thing, because people were threatened. You know, he knew what the Nazis were like. He was working with them, so he was very careful to kind of double back the story, so people didn't get into trouble or get killed. And indeed, I can't find the name of the author anywhere else on the internet, so it's just like kind of one-off thing. Anyway, so his name was Otto Cerny. And he was one of the first four scientists who worked on the Glock at Kassel Gzatz. K-S-I-A-Z or K-Z-I-A-S. And it's pronounced something like Siaz or I don't know how your German is. Anyway, it's down in Silesia in Owl Mountains or something. And in this castle, they started to do research, and it was a very imperative thing. And they were connected with there's a chapter in this book where they go to see the Vril Diamond. And the chief scientist, whose name is Seeger, Rudolf Seeger, is a he's a family man who lost his family in the war, and, you know, he's got nothing left to lose, so he's just like completely focused. Anyway, so he goes to see the channelers, and it wasn't Maria, it was another woman, an older woman, they say. I can't remember what her name was. Madame something. Anyway, so she goes into this trance and starts channeling this being called Anquil from Aldebaran. And Anquil tells them, he basically has a conversation with Seeger, you know, using Maria, using the Vril Diamond as a you know, telephone, essentially. And he says, you know, so how are you going on with the project? And he says, well, we're having trouble with the electromagnetic drives. And he says, ah, right, well, you're using electromagnetism, and what you need is Vril. And Vril is an unstable compound, and it's this and it's that. He has no idea of what he's talking about. He just, you know, remembers everything that he says. It's an unstable radioactive element that is ferromagnetic fluid, right? And he just remembers these words. He doesn't, you know, what they're talking about, but he just remembers these words. And so he goes back to the castle, and he's then in a meeting with Hans Kammler, who's the Übergruppenführer, and so he's in charge of the whole business, another scientist who is your absolute archetypal crazy German scientist, Dr. Strangelove character. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and his name is Werner Eckert. Why is it these guys called Werner? It's like Vernon. You know the guy in Waco? He's called Vernon. Anyway. So, Werner Ecker is your crazy scientist, and he's been working on this stuff he called Serum 525. You might have heard, this might have come across you. So, he discovers that if you boil mercury in a plutonium reactor with various things, and he's been chucking iron filings and thorium and calcium and, you know, all sorts of bits and pieces into this, and then boiling it in this plutonium reactor at many thousands of degrees for, you know, several months. And he's like got like 2 grams of it. It's taken weeks and weeks of having the entire output of an entire power station running this thing, you know, to get the energy in to make this serum 525. And so he's in the meeting, and he's talking to the two of them, and so Seeger says to him, you know, what the Vrildarman crazy witch, they all call them the crazy witches, what she said was, you know, we need some material that is, and he kind of stumbles on the ferromagnetic fluid, and Eckert says, maybe this is what, yeah, I've been working on something like that. And so they realize that they've actually created the material that they need to use, all kind of independently. And this is the famed red mercury, and it's a kind of purple liquid,
yes,
purple metallic liquid. So
highly toxic.
Highly toxic. But apparently in very, very, very tiny quantities is like a benefit, but really, really tiny. Medicinal is medicinal red mercury. You can check it out. But anyway, so that was what I got from this book, and it's just that sounded just like the key to the whole weapons research that they were doing.
Okay, good. According to this book, what was the purpose of the Diglocka?
It creates the portal that the Harnibus yes. fly through.
Yes. Okay. Okay. See, this is I think a lot of disinformation within UFO research and so forth. They think that the Diglocka or the Bitnazi Bell was a flying machine in and of itself, but it's like, you know, you stop and think about what they were doing with it. It's like, wait a minute, and it was so highly toxic that you couldn't be in, you know, the men that worked on it, you know, they would just drop dead.
Well, that's true.
This technology is so dangerous. It's like, well, what good would it be to make a flying machine out of it? And this is Joseph Farrell's main thrust of his research in this field, which he has done a tremendous amount of research on the Diglocka, is that they were
pushing the
absolute limits of torsion physics with
yes.
Diglocka. It's like they weren't interested in making a flying machine. They'd already done that years earlier. No big deal. But they understood that the torsion physics that makes a UFO fly can be used for other, you know, if you just keep ramping up the power, it's like, yeah, you can create a wormhole.
Okay, so, now, here's the thing. We use the word clock, right?
Yes.
But it's developed from the German word Glocke.
Yes.
Which means bell. So it's pronounced die Glocke.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it comes from the same word. So it's a time machine as well, which is why it's an interesting, you know, the bell shape is kind of almost coincidental. It's, if you imagine that the bell shape, if you could then you stick a disc on that, you could make a flying saucer, right. But
you could make it bloody go anywhere you wanted to go.
Yeah, but
you could make it go to any when, not
exactly.
just anywhere,
exactly.
any when.
Exactly.
So you can fly through time and space, and that's the whole dynamic of torsion physics.
That's right. Well, we'll get there later. Let me just go back with a bit more Glock news. All right, because what's also going on is they do their first test of the thing, and they crank it up. So they ask Eckert, you know, okay, how much of this stuff has you made? And he says, we've made about 4 or 5 grams. and they said, how much do you want? And he says, well, we need 2 tons. Because, well, imagine a ton of mercury is not going to take up that much space. So what they have are 2 cylinders that are mounted on a gimbal. And these two cylinders are full of the mercury, mm-hmm. and they are rotated.
Counter-rotated
against each other, that's right. Mm-hmm. And that they are then charged, or I think actually just... I think they were charged externally, but once the charge was in there, it would just keep going. It was superconductive. But so they switched the thing on, and the first thing it did, it started to it kind of just shifted a little bit. It just nudged itself on the ground. This is in the famous henge that has been seen.
Yes,
And they
it's a Risa complex in Poland.
That's right, the Risa complex. Now Risa means giant. For those people, and the name of this project, you know, like we have in America, they have Project Rainbow and all this. This was called Project Giant or Project Risa, because it was a gigantic project, no human had ever done this before, and this is the largest number of people that have ever been working on a project that nobody has ever heard of. So it was huge. That's why it was, you know, it was called Giant, and they have various other facilities. In parallel, in tandem, once the research was done, once they did encountered a bit more research and did a bit more design, other facilities would recreate these designs. We find out in a while what happened. But so they start creating the red mercury. One of the things they notice about red mercury is that A, it's highly toxic, B, you can make zombies with it. In fact, you can make all kinds of very, very nasty esoteric weapons with red mercury.
Right.
And in the basement of XATS, that's what they were doing in the Project Rhys. This was one of the things. And these are the things that mad scientist Werner Eckert was doing. And he was like in this separate section of the facility making the red mercury but also testing it, and he would bring in, you know, food and things and people and sheep and horrible things would happen on exposure to this radiation, including zombieism.
Okay.
And the idea that you could have a dead body that was reanimated by this vril. And that was one of the secret weapons that was part of the Wunderwaffe project.
Absolutely.
And the Wunderwaffe was, I think there were, Hitler said, give me four options. And one of those would be deployed through the time field vortex that the Glock would create. So you would, one of the ideas was literally to teleport a nuclear weapon onto Washington. No warning. That was one of the things that Eckert tabled. But here's the thing, this is the thing you're going to love, is Hitler said, no, that's too cruel. I know, it's like, why don't they give Hitler vodka? Because it makes him mean, you know. But see, he literally,
Hitler had a heart after all, right?
So anyway, there's a little download for you.
Okay, that's amazing. Well, that's not the end of the story. It's like the Doug Lockett, the Bell, the scientists, Hans Kammler, all simply disappeared at the end of the war.
Well, have you heard of The Sands of Time by Sean David Morton? Morton.
No.
You haven't? Do you know who Sean David Morton is?
Yeah, I know who he is, yeah.
Okay, he's a radio presenter. I actually produce for him on occasion. And co-host, and actually I'll be holding one of his shows next week, I think.
Excellent.
But he has written a book, and his book was sourced by a friend of his father's. He grew up in California, in Silicon Valley, the Hermosa Beach, the center of the military-industrial complex. This is where all the Nazis have gone, right? Okay. So a friend of his father who was a publicity guy for... I can't remember the name of it. It was a three-letter abbreviation, but they're a connection with Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin and all these
people. Not JPL, is it?
No, not JPL. It was something like TRW. Three letters, I don't know. Anyway, the guy who ran the secret government was this figure that in the book is called Ted Humphreys. It's not his real name. And this is another book that Ted Humphreys, at the end of the last century, you know, in 2009, I think, disappeared, moved on. And then his lawyers called Sean into their offices, and Sean was like, oh my God, what's going to be happening? Well, you know, why did they bring me into this? The, you know, the top poshest lawyers in the universe. And they handed this pile of books over, this pile of journals, and said, this is from your Uncle Ted. He said, if you change the names of all of the people in here so nobody gets found out, or we'll kill you, and all your cats, probably, you know, you can publish this. And he's written two volumes so far of three, called The Sands of Time, Tempus Fugit Chronicles. And it shows from the other side, right? This is somebody who was inside the projects that created Area 51 and Montauk and all of that stuff. So this is from deep in the inside and why it happened. So where this comes in is at the beginning of the book, our leader, our he's just graduated, he's bumming around, he's his father disappeared about 5 years previously, he gets taken into a potential project because of his father's knowledge. His father obviously worked on time travel and things like that, and taught in physics and was part of that. So he gets taken into a project. Now, what they had the problem was is that Philadelphia Experiment and the Bell both ripped holes in space-time. And through these holes, they've discovered that there is an extraterrestrial race on its way to us. No kidding. Right? So it's really important to be able to either A, seal up the hole, or B, defend ourselves against these ETs.
Right.
So, for this reason, the secret space program was launched. However, they still hadn't solved the problem of healing the rift in space-time.
Right, right. Have you shared this with Simon Parks?
Have you dialogued
with Simon Parks about this stuff? I think it would be a very, very interesting show.
Oh, yeah. We will. We'll have him on next week, so maybe this will
excellent,
be...
Excellent, because this segues right into what he has to say about the CERN.
Yeah, okay.
The CERN Stargate and all that.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so here's the thing, and this is where Kamala comes in, right?
Yes.
Because it turns out, right, so the beginning of the book, he's sent to this Arctic island as a volcanic, it's an old volcano peak that just juts through the water, and there's a Russian submarine you can get in from underwater. And there's a Russian submarine parked inside the inside the thing, and they've made a base out of it. And in this base is a joint U.S.-Russian prison for one. And in there is... And this is why I played the Wagner at the beginning, just before the show started.
Okay.
I played The Morning Star by Wagner. Because inside this room, our hero walks in to Hans Kammler. There he is, and he's listening to Wagner. He's drinking the Russians' vodka. He's got nothing to do. He's reading. He's just sitting there, and he has to develop a relationship with him so that Kamala can give up his information, which is how to seal the hole back up once you've opened it. How not to make a tear. How to just kind of peel the layers apart gently.
Right.
And what's interesting about this is that Kamala never actually tells him, but our hero works it out for himself. But once he does so, all hell breaks loose. And the submarine is wired to it. Well, basically, it's a nuclear sub, and and the power from the nuclear submarine creates hot water, so everybody's got lovely showers, and they run the whole base off the submarine's power station, you know. But it's still a submarine. It's still, you know, a couple of jumper cables down there, like the Russians, you know, a couple of great big jumper cables, and that's how everybody gets their power. So, anyway, it gets very exciting. You know, once he discovers the thing, they have to get off the island. He rescues a Russian woman,
he throws in a little melodrama along the way, right?
Yeah, there's a bit of melodrama.
Okay.
Anyway, so the thing is that the upshot is that the thing blows up. The hero gets away, gets rescued by another submarine, and then goes back to the facility and is taken into the top secret organization. Now he's got the keys. They can let him in because it was like his father started the organization or was part of the beginning of the organization. So that's the Sands of Time, and that's who Uncle Ted was. Or Ted Humphreys. He's not his real name, but that's who it was. And so the upshot is that the Russians captured Kamla and kept him prisoner until he could be interrogated by somebody proficient.
Mm.
Interesting. I don't know that I buy it. I'm not sure that I buy that, but I'm fairly certain that Hans Kamla survived the war. But I'm not so sure he was captured by the Russians. I'm not so sure. I'm thinking that he was more astute than that, and that he probably would have cut a deal with the Americans before even Wernher von Braun.
Well, here's the thing. In Die Glocke, the book, right at the end, Kamla is murdered by Eckert. He throws him into a spinning machine, basically minced.
That would have been a fitting end for Kamla, anyway.
Exactly. But here's the thing, and this is my belief is that they all had body doubles.
Yes.
And that what they actually did was capture a body double of Kamla, who'd been briefed on his life, and because he says, you know, I knew your father and la di da di da di da, but. I believe that Humphreys actually spoke to one of Kamla's doubles, who never gave the game away. Mm-hmm. He played it to the end, and you got to admire these Nazis. They play it to the beat, you know. They really get it down, and so it may not have been Kamla, but the guy worked it out himself, and that was his key. And what then they were doing was, and this was the project, to teleport. It was just like a sniffing robot, you know, took samples and air samples and stuff like that from inside a nuclear explosion at the time of its explosion, so they could work out about the expansions and all this stuff. So they basically teleported a camera to the dark side of the moon, or the shadow of the moon, so it could super cool, teleported it from there inside a Russian nuclear weapon test back to the moon to cool it back down again, and then back into the laboratory. That was the project, and this is what Fred Bell was working on. I don't know if you've heard of Fred Bell, but that was one of his early projects. This is where he was involved in. This is why he knew so much about time travel and all of this stuff.
Wow, well, that's way out there, but that's very interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah, all right, so... So that's where it all started, and so they wanted to be able to figure out how to do the undoing of the time travel thing, so that they wouldn't rip holes in space-time whenever they did this teleportation trick.
Exactly.
Right. So this is now. When's this? In the 1950s, or this is made late 50s, I'd say this was set. So he'd been in there for about 15 years, in the prison.
Well, it's amazing. I just watched. I got to watch a film just last weekend. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's called The Wolf, and it's a dramatic recreation, documentary, semi-documentary, of Hitler's last years in Argentina.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Father Crispy.
Right. They've assembled eyewitness testimony from all these people who claim that they worked at the compound, they were cooks and servants and chauffeurs and this and that, and doctors that all claim that they had, that yes, and Hitler, the real Hitler, had survived the war and spent his last years actually in Argentina, at a compound in Argentina. And I was like, if these eyewitness accounts are to be believed, it tells an extraordinary story.
There's an even more.
At that point, Hitler, virtually had no power, and that it was Martin Bormann that actually carried on the Reich after that. They just, out of courtesy, they let Hitler die peacefully in Argentina, and actually it was Martin Bormann who created the off the books international Nazi international economic structure. That he kind of caught on to the idea, well, you're not going to beat the Brits and the Americans, militarily, but you might be able to beat them economically. And so that's really the upshot of Joseph Farrell's research, ever since the end of the war, that actually Martin Bormann at the end was really the more powerful.
Excellent. Because Bormann does appear in Die Glock as well. And Hitler, actually, for a very short time. Let's just go back to the first test. So they sparked this thing up. They sparked up the bell. And it was a smallish version. I think it was about like half the size of the final one. And it starts glowing green and starts glowing blue at first. And it rocks a little bit, and they crank up the power a little bit, and it kind of wobbles, and 5% more power, and it lifts off the ground. And it's just sitting there, bobbing, just kind of bobbing away. By the way, these the motors that are running this thing, it's really screaming away. And so they then crank it, it gets about 20 feet off the ground. And then they've got a navigator on it. They've got a remote controller, a joystick. And he says, okay, just move it a little bit to the left. So it moves a little bit to the left. Moves it. And move it back. Okay, moves back. Okay, give it some welly. Push the stick hard as you can. See how fast it'll go. And instead of traveling very fast, it snaps out and instantly it snaps over across. I said, wow. Do the same way the other way.
That sounds plausible. Now, is there any mention in this material of the Kecksburg, Pennsylvania UFO?
Please wait. We will try to connect you. That comes.
That
comes later.
Because the Die Glock, as it was described, along the base, there were inscriptions that actually looked like, I don't know, Celtic runes. Or I don't know if it was even ancient Sumerian.
I believe.
There were these strange writing, runes. Character,
runes,
you know,
yes.
Along the base of the Die Glocke. And then that was also a description of the Kecksburg UFO.
Correct. We will get there. We've got 20 minutes. Let's see if we can get there. Okay, so here's the thing. So the first test, they flick the thing, and they could navigate it, but when they press the joystick hard, it wouldn't just move, it would disappear and then reappear elsewhere instantaneously, silently, so they then crank it up a little bit more, and there's a kind of green mist going, And
just like the Philadelphia experiment.
Yes.
The ship disappears in a green mist, right?
And okay. Then they turn it up a little bit more and oh, where's it gone? But the guy who's on the navigator says, oh, still here. Huh? So they discover that they've got something that can instantaneously travel in a direction and something that is invisible on demand.
Right.
That was the first testing of the Glock. The next test, they invited Hitler and Bormann and everybody, because this is just the scientists. The next test, they invited Hitler and everybody to it. And they then chain the bell to the hinge.
Yes.
And they got these massive titanium chains. Huge, really heavy duty. They really know that this thing's going to kick. And they crank it up and bun 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 bun, and does the blue thing, the green thing, and then disappears. And they have a spy in their midst who tipped off the Allies, and so a plane comes hurtling towards the castle to bomb it. But the vortex that this thing has created draws the plane into it, into the henge, and the plane crashes. And when they watch it, it is in slow motion.
I would think it would simply have disintegrated.
It was mangled. Everything was mangled. Obviously, the thing stopped, doing the vortex. And but Hitler went down there, and the guy who wrote the book was standing near him when he said it, and he could hear. He muttered, "The witches were right."
I dare say.
Yeah. So that was the first test of the Glock, which showed that it was powerful. Whatever power it had, it was really powerful. So they then decided, right, okay, let's go for it. Let's throw as much as we can. And so they threw all their resources into building as many of them as they could.
This is very interesting, Jay, because I just read Reich of the Black Sun by Joseph Farrell, and he talks about a lot of this same material. In fact, he reveals that the Nazis did successfully detonate an atomic bomb in December of 1944 up in the Baltic. And the popular history is that the Nazis didn't have good enough technology to build an atomic bomb. Well, according to Joseph Farrell, says yes, they did have the technology to build the atomic bomb, but they wanted something even more powerful. They wanted a weapon that was a really super weapon, and that the Die Glocke, this torsion energy, this distortion of the torsion field, they said could create a bomb, could create an explosion that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. So it's like this is the ultimate technology that they were really going after. It's like, atomic bomb, yeah, so what? Let's find something bigger. Let's find something even more powerful than an atomic bomb. And this is why, he argues, this is why the Germans, they developed the atomic bomb, but they kept going after something even bigger and more powerful.
Exactly.
And once again, this is the technology that simply vanished at the end of the war.
So yeah, this is the Wunderwaffe.
Or vanished. Simply became incorporated into American technology.
Exactly.
Because it's like, if you look at Wernher von Braun, it's like it's like the V2 rocket program just got shifted over to the United States and kept going without even missing a beat. It was like, well, we'd just slap an American flag on it, and we'll keep right on going with this technology. And it's like, you think, well, my God, if they did this with rocket technology, were they doing the same thing with this torsion technology?
Well, yes, indeed. And so we've got the so I want to give you more. I've just also put in the chat room, and I'll drop it into the chat here so that you can actually listen to it in your leisure. which is my the reading of Die Glocke is available from that folder, and just to give you a couple more nuggets in our last few minutes, because we got to get to. So what happens at the end of the war? The Allies are approaching, and they know they're coming. And Sporenberg is told to go and kill everybody, wipe out all the information. They've already reproduced the bell. They've made several models. One, they did a test, and they sent it through the vortex, and it was like ruined. It was just completely chewed away. It was like corroded from the inside. It must have been leaks, the invalid containment field. And because containment fields are really important these days. When they so the Allies were coming in on there, Sporenberg was in there, Rudolf Seeger and his girlfriend Helga Wilhelm do escape in the Glock. They crank it up, and they crank it up all the way, and it poofs out of existence. It poofs out of 1944.
Well, what did it poof into?
1965, okay. December 1965.
Okay. And Pennsylvania?
In Pennsylvania, in Kecksburg, which is interestingly a German name. Mm. Yeah. So there must be some kind of quantum entanglement. There is stories that there. I mean, the quantum. Anyways, let's keep going. Basically, yes, it was Die Glocke. They were escaping from Sporenberg, killing everybody. They knew she was a spy, and so he escaped with her because he was in love with her. Long story. Read the book. It's the love interest. Anyway.
How romantic.
Very, very. This is romantic beyond space and time. So anyway, this bell is recovered by the military and taken back to Edwards or wherever it was taken to. And they bring Otto, who is now a NASA scientist. Oh, it's so close. Otto is now a NASA scientist working on the space program, but he worked on this thing every day 20 years previously. Mm-hmm. And so he knew what it was. And so they had this thing stuck on the ramp, sticking on the lorry, and suddenly they hear this great big and these big iron sounding doors opening. Stairs coming down, and out steps a jackboot with Hans Kammler on the other end of them, and his girlfriend, and they step out of the Glock.
Have you seen the movie Iron Sky?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Much of this is so reminiscent of Iron Sky.
Yeah, very much.
And Iron Sky is a film that's produced with
tongue
as
firmly.
A comedy, as a political satire.
But when they say that the Nazis are going to come back, and was it 2018 or 2017? I'm like, sometimes I watch that movie and I wonder, is this really the scheduled return?
That could well be. So anyway,
could well be.
Yeah. Yes. So anyway, we got. There's more. There's more. Okay, so yes, Kecksburg was Die Glocke. Kecksburg was the reappearance of Die Glocke 20 years' time. There's this 20-year time thing that they have, these time programs, don't they? The Philadelphia experiment, the ship appears every 20 years, isn't it? So there's a 20-year thing. So we find that the Glocke still works, and what they realized is that Werner Eckert was still kind of on the loose, and this is really interesting because we see it in the book. Otto sees it from two perspectives. is quite amazing. Because what they discover is that, remember I said before, all the Serum 525 is quantum entangled. Because it's been boiled at such a high temperature, etc., it's quantum entangled. So every piece of that batch, if one piece of that batch goes quantum, all the other pieces do too.
Of course.
And so if there's any other pieces of that batch that are in operation, they will spark up. And what they found is whenever they did tests of Diglocker, over on the other side of the compound, there was all this lightning that was striking where Werner Eckert was working, you know, the crazy scientist. So he'd obviously snickered off a couple of bottles of his own, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
Anyway, so they're making 2 tons, a little bit, you know, a few grams weren't noticed. Anyway, so what happens is that the hero, as it were, Rudolf Seeger, fires up Diglocker again, creates a wormhole with it, steps back through the wormhole, back to 1943, steps through another wormhole that takes him into the laboratory where Werner Eckert has just killed Hans Kammler. Eckert has just thrown him into this mincing machine sort of thing. And out from this sort of gateway, Stargate gateway, steps our hero Seeger, shoots Eckert dead, and then steps back into the wormhole. The wormhole closes up and goes. And Otto saw that in 1943, but also he witnessed him going into the wormhole from the other side, from the future, going back in time to do that particular thing. So what happened is, so I'll just sum that up for our listeners who are a bit, you know, perplexed by what I just said. The leader of the Glock project, Rudolf Seeger, and his girlfriend escaped being murdered by Hitler's hitmen by firing up the Glock and coming forwards in time. It appeared as the Pennsylvania, Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, the UFO sighting, which was then taken to an Air Force base. They then fired it back up again once they found out who they were, fired it back up again, created a portal back into back through space and time to 1943, created another portal to the other side of the castle, killed the scientists who just killed Kammler, stepped back and then went back into the future, and then became one of the only time-traveling Nazis.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
So there you go. That's a very interesting possibility
Because you know at the air base where they took the Kecksburg object, not very long after they were at the airbase, that the commandant or whoever was in charge of the operation, that they requisitioned these special ceramic tiles that this thing could only be fired up if it was protected, if it was in encased or enclosed within these very special ceramic tiles.
Yes, I've heard
of that. So it's like, somebody must have known that there was a way to fire it up again and so forth. But yeah, it you know, Jay, it's just amazing. It's just an amazing story, and it goes off in so many directions. Now, the other thing in the mix that we, if you go to my website, which is jimnicholsufo.net, one of my, along with my Aldebaran mystery, one of my more recent blogs and videos, actually, is called The Aeon of Horus, which is NASA's occult history. And if you have to start to ask the question that, well, were American secret societies also working in concert with the Nazi SS at the highest levels? Were all these secret societies actually brotherhoods? Were rather than being enemies and rivals, were they working together? Because during the Apollo program at the highest level of NASA, you had Wernher von Braun's Nazis, you had Jack Parsons, Alistair Crowley, magicians, and then you had high-ranking 33rd degree Freemasons. So it's like there's this occult convergence, you know, that seems to happen. You see it specifically within NASA after the war. And once again, it's like the individual who had the greatest power and authority in regards to directing the Apollo program and picking out all the landing sites and training the astronauts was an Egyptian whose father was an expert on the ancient secret mysteries of Horus and Isis and Osiris, who the gang that we saw in that boat in ancient Egypt. So it's like, is there a direct link between this torsion physics and the Bell and NASA's occult hierarchy?
Jim, can you come back? We haven't finished, have we? It's 2 hours. We have just wrapped.
You can't cover this in 2 hours.
I know. It's been 2 hours, but it's been fantastic. Jim Nichols, UFO.net. Check out this stuff. This guy is amazing, folks. Check out his art. It reminds me of, you probably were influenced by it, but 1950s comic art. Like the Neil Adams and all that stuff.
More 1950s science fiction movies. You know, I love the movies.
Excellent.
And, you know, it came from outer space and War of the Worlds and Forbidden Planet. That stuff, you know, those are profound images that are embedded in my mind. And it's like, then that's came out later in my artwork. So, yeah, I'm a brat of the 50s for sure.
Excellent. So thank you so much. you know, Sean, he gave me some tapes of an Andromedan craft.
Right.
And of a Pleiadian craft. Now, these are supposedly Billy Meyer. Hey, we haven't even touched Billy Meyer and whatever happened to me. I think we're going to have to leave Maria for another show because she deserves a show all by herself. I'd love to find out as much as I can about Maria. And the rest. Actually, we only know two of the Drill Darman. And there's more. They said there were 10
of
them.
Well, you know, they made a cryptic comment at the end of the war that they would come back, that they would be back.
They said, I'll be back first before Arnold, did I?
So when I see a movie like Iron Sky, I thought, you know, maybe they were deadly serious when they said that.
Where are you born? We are born on the dark side of the moon. Brilliant. I love that film. I really do. I'm going to have to watch it again.
We haven't talked about Admiral Byrd. We haven't talked about the Antarctic. And we haven't talked to... There's so much that we just haven't even begun.
Jim, please come back. I've had such a buzz. Our audience has had such a buzz. Next week, I'll be talking to Simon Parks. Yes, we will discuss Die Glocke. We will discuss... We'll see what he knows. Because... his mother, you know, his mother was typist of Project
Paperboy. Absolutely, right.
So, yeah. So, excellent.
And have him draw the connection between Die Glocke and CERN.
CERN, yes, because that brings it all up to date. Because what I'm trying to do...
There's a good show right there.
Yeah. What I'm trying to do with people is to get them up to speed. But if you don't know about the Glock, you don't know what the speed is.
Right.
You know,
right.
And the speed is beyond the speed of light. Jim Nichols, it's been a real pleasure, a joy, a buzz, a I felt the vril flow in my veins.
Okay, well, we got the vril mojo going here. Okay, very good. Well, thank you so much, Jay. It's been delightful.
It's been delightful. Thank you very much. Good night, everybody. Stand by. We're going over to Frank Jordan and the Earth Mind Think Tank Group, the Earth Healers Group, and we have a lecture about metaphysics, and then an hour we take healing requests. So if you know anybody who's not well, or you're not well yourself, you can ask for a request. You can put that in the chat room. So thank you very much, Jim Nichols. This has been Ever Beyond. This has been Ever Beyond. There we go.
So we are.
Next week we'll be with Simon Parks, like I said, and stay tuned. It's going to be great. So this has been Ever Beyond. It takes a while before the thing comes on. Beyond.